Welcome to After the Collapse with Jim Vernon and Lewis Maroney. I'm Lewis, and we are at afterthecollapse.net and also air on radioregent.com. This show catches a fiery talk by Mi'kmaq warriors Suzanne Patlis and Cody Stevens at the Toronto Council Fire Native Cultural Centre in Toronto's East End. Patlis and Stevens were on a speaking tour to spread information about their work resisting the encroachment of industrial fracking in the area surrounding Elzebuktuk First Nation in New Brunswick, and the legal battles that followed in its wake.
Next up, we have Suzanne and Cody. Okay, you are here. from the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society. So welcome, Suzanne and Cody. To our territory here, and thanks so much for sharing with us today.
Gwe, Dinda Luisi, Suzanne, Wedebeksi, Mi'kma'ki. Hi, my name is Suzanne Patlis. I'm from the Mi'kmaq territory, and I'm here on behalf of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society to come share our struggle for emancipating our nation and our struggle to defeat the corporate colonialism and our struggle against the state creating political prisoners of war out of our men. And the struggle that we have against industry and our path so far up to this point. So in saying that, I want to thank you guys all out for, you know, for taking your time to come out here and to sit here and, you know, hear what we have to say of the message that we came to bring. Basically, our message has been simple throughout our journey, and it's to tell people to stand up, to make the stand that we made out east. You know, what's to stop everybody? Everybody's wondering in astonishment and wondering, well, how did they do it? We did it just by getting up off our ass and getting out there. After coming back from Chemical Valley, it really impacted me on a deep level, where there are 63 industrial areas around a reserve, where their cemetery is surrounded by industry. Like, there's a road that's the only part that's not surrounded by industry. There's flares, there's plumes that go up at night. And that's an example of what's going to happen if we start to allow industry to come creeping into our territories, and when we allow them to come creeping into our communities. And it's something that we can't stand for, which is why we stood so hard in our territory, because a lot of our territory, from coming out and visiting all of these different areas, we live in a pristine territory, and a lot of these places that we've been have been plundered by industry. They have come in and they've raped our mother. They've come in and destroyed everything, and in legal terms they would call that alienation of Aboriginal title. So regardless of how you want to put it, either in legal terms or in Indigenous terms, it's a gross violation. And and I'm glad that we had women here standing up against sexual violence, because as Warrior Society members, we believe that, you know, there's no women abuse, there's no rapist, because the same thing, our mother is our Mother Earth, and the same thing with our mothers and our sisters, we don't put up with that. So I was really glad to hear that being brought into the movement, because that's something that's important that needs to be acknowledged. But in same with our struggle against SWN Resources, a lot of people didn't hear that we defeated a company already called Petroworth Resources that came into our territory. We made them broke. It's important to keep track of their stock market to see how you're affecting their pocket, because the only way to affect a corporation is to snip at its pockets and to really affect it on a profound level. So that's what we decided, the angle that we were going to display, and we're going to come at it with a multi-layered approach. But because of our efforts and our research and everything, there was a blockade, and everybody knows about the October 17th raid. There was months and months of action and ongoing dispute between the RCMP, between the company, and between the society, and between the community of Elsie Bukduk and the allies and supporters, because it wasn't just one community standing up, it was a community standing up with everybody. So it was a combined effort on behalf of everybody, and that's what people don't seem to understand. You know, they're trying to isolate it to a certain group or certain individuals when it was everybody coming together. So on that day, they came in and they say that they arrested 40 people. There's recent things in the media. We don't listen to the media. It does kind of want to affect you on an emotional level, but we can't allow that to deter us from our path, because the RCMP tried, when they came and they attacked us, they attacked our grandmothers, they attacked our youth, they sprayed them, they beat them. It's the same thing they did to us on the inside. They beat us with the assault rifles, with their boots, and they're going to pay for their actions, and it's... just because they're trying to slander us in the media doesn't mean that what they did was right. So we're going to combat them in the best way we know how, and that's both in the courts and on the ground. So with our political prisoners of war, my partner, my spouse, Jermaine Bro, is still incarcerated. My warrior brother, Aaron Francis, is still incarcerated. And we were able to show people that when we work together, either when the fight is on the inside and on the outside, that it can be a success. They were thrown into solitary confinement, and with the lobbying efforts of their lawyers and the power of the people, we were able to pull them out of solitary confinement, and we were also able to change the facility, and they were not allowed an elder to come in. They weren't allowed to be smudged, but now they have their own smudge kit. So we're able to, you know, create fundamental change just by implementing an idea. And that's what it's all about, is not having these ideas and thoughts inside of your head. It's actually taking action and actually getting out there and doing things and creating that change that you could foresee, because without you taking those action steps, then there's no use of you just holding them back in your own mind. And after our journey, we went through the West Coast and its beautiful resistance culture that they have created out there. So the other message that we had that we received from there was to create a resistance culture, whether it be through art, poetry, music, whatever it is that you're good at or entertains you, use that to create a style of resistance. So that, because right now it is a revolution, we don't live in a democratic society, and we need change, and we need to demand it in every possible way. And for that source of resistance to be normalized, because I was raised in a resistance family where my grandmother, who raised me as my mother, she refused to go to Indian Day School. She decided to be raised by her grandmother. Her father refused to allow his children to be sent to the residential school. He told the Indian agent that he was going to shoot his head off if he touched his children. So that's the kind of resistance that was normalized in my life. So when we normalize these kind of things, our children become stronger. We become stronger as individuals and as nations when we're able to move forward and to be able to say no to the oppressor, and not to allow anybody to come into our lives and tell us what's going to happen. Because my children, you know, I don't want to see who's going to step in their way, because they're probably going to be more fierce than I am. And my grandchildren are probably going to be even worse. So we have to normalize that so that we have a better future. We have to be those good ancestors, that our ancestors were good to us. So I'm going to pass it over to Cody, because I believe his message is really important. He was on the first part of the tour with me in British Columbia, and I dragged him back to Southern Ontario for you guys to hear. So I'm gonna let him go.
Mirabolotio, mean the Louis Cody Jibo, who died biggest snooty of Kisku, Bijijik Sidio, Dom Vitelui. Hello, everyone. My name is Cody Stevens. I want to thank everyone for showing up here today and listening to what I have to say. I believe it's a little important that I explain a little bit about why I became a warrior before I talk about what happened in Elsie Bukduk, because I believe that's very important to bring out. For me, becoming a warrior, I became a warrior during what happened in the burnt church. It was an awakening moment in my life. I seen the culture of resistance, and I was pretty amazed by what was going on. And I wanted to become a warrior, so I made up my mind that time that I wanted to become a warrior. And I asked my mom, I was 16. I said, Mom, can I go to Burn Church? And she said, no way. You're not going near Burn Church, she said. So I couldn't go. And turns out after everything happened in Burn Church, I got kicked out not very long after. And I still wanted to be a warrior, and it was, I guess it was just more of wanting to fight for a better future for my people. But when I had children, I have a daughter and a son, and for me it was a little personal because I grew up in the Mi'kmaq territory within our nation. We face many social issues around, and social issues are they're plentiful around, and there's so many issues that we need to deal with. And I believe in order for us to move forward, we need to start dealing with these issues. For me, I have suffered from 10 years of institutional oppression. I suffered from addiction, I suffered from thoughts of suicide, and I also suffered from losing many friends through suicide. In 2007, I went to jail. I did a bit of 10 months. And during that 10 months, I did time with 23 Mi'kmaq inmates. And this is just within one block. This is not other inmates in the jail. Out of that 23 inmates, 11 are dead today. 10 of them are from suicide, and one of them is from overdose. So that gives me a 50-50 chance of having the same outcome. And during that 10 years, I kept going to court, and the judge would tell me, Cody, how could you do this to your community? How could you be this evil man, and how could you contribute to these social issues in your community? And I believe the judge, I thought to myself, I said, man, geez, I really am an evil man. How could I do this to my community? Yet I didn't realize that it was the government that created this demon that I had become. For 500 years, the Mi'kmaq people and people across Turtle Island have suffered oppression from the government. It has been through the Scalping Proclamation, it's been through residential school, it was through, I can go on all day about what they've done wrong. And it was their design to create the outcome of my life to become this evil man. It was not a path that I chose for my life. It was a path that was chosen for me the day I was born a Mi'kmaq person. And it was inevitable where I was headed. And I try to think, okay, these social issues, I want to change my life around. I want to become a better person for my community. But the more that I try to change to become a better person for my community, the more I realize how much injustices are committed against our people every day. And my grandmother went to the residential school, and many residential school survivors, it's so recent in history that many of the survivors are alive today. And the residential school, many horror stories emerged from the residential school. Stories of torture, of rape, of horrible instances. And these are children that were taken into the residential school. And for me, being a warrior, instead of my children being taken from my home and taken into these institutions where they're being oppressed, I took it upon myself to be to sacrifice myself, to be the one to go to jail, to be the one to fight, so that my children don't have to grow up in the same conditions that I grew up in. I think about my mom, how difficult it must have been for her when I was a child growing up, when my friend would commit suicide. And I want a little bit of advice from my mother, but she didn't, growing up in her time, it wasn't that big of a thing. So it's not, we don't have things in place where you teach your children how to overcome a friend's suicide. And I don't want to be the one. It got personal. Like I look at my son, and they can't even speak for themselves. They can't speak against what's being committed against them. My son is so innocent. He can barely speak. He speaks few words, and he's starting to speak Mi'kmaq. And he doesn't understand what's going on in the country. Yet here's this government that's planning the same horror stories as my life, as they got the same plans for my son. And my son's going to be headed in the same direction because he was born in a First Nation community. I don't want that for my children. I don't want my children to be burying their friends. I don't want my children to go into jail. I don't want my children to go to rehab, detox, to suffer from addiction, to experiment with all kinds of drugs. I experimented with lots of drugs. I did every drug in the book besides the needle. And it was hell of a road for me, and it was difficult. During that time, when you're addicted to drugs, you become a smaller person. And during that 10 years, I had no pride. I was an Indian by color. I was an Indian in my blood. But I didn't have my tradition. I didn't have my culture. Those very things that were ripped from my people. And that's why you have so many social issues on the reserve, like suicide or addictions, because they, over the years, they try so much to break the Indian, to take our culture away from us, that we got nothing left. Our people are lost. Our people are lost and don't know what to do, and yet here they are turning to drugs, feeling that's the only way they can get past, or feeling that the only way out is through suicide. I try not to bring these issues out. Back home, when you talk about stuff like that, people will say, hey, stop talking about that, because many of the people are traumatized. It affects the whole community as a whole, and they're all traumatized. There's no open discussion about it. I believe it's time when we start talking about these issues that people don't talk about. We need to be able to have an open discussion within the communities. We need to get together as a community and find ways to deal with these issues. And sometimes when people say, okay, you're going to fight, we got to find one thing to fight for, because everyone's got different plans. But the issues that First Nation people face, if you're going to fix one thing, and when you start fixing that one thing, you notice that there's many things that are connected to that. So in order to fix that one issue, such as suicide, there's many things you have to fix first in order to fix that issue. And that was why I became a warrior, to make sure my children don't grow up in those same conditions. I don't want none of that, not only for my children, for my nieces and nephews, for all First Nation kids. Because the future ahead, the way it's going right now, the children's future, by the time they have grandchildren, they're not going to have much left. These companies coming in, taking our land. We went to Chemical Valley. I have never seen something like that. The First Nation community is right in the smack middle of so much industry. There's no matter which way the wind goes, the steam is blowing into the reserve. It smells like a permanent market. And it was difficult for me seeing the graveyard, because like when you have a funeral, you're supposed to have a funeral in peace, not beside these big companies that have big, these refineries, they look terrible. Like you can hear steam whistling. It's not a sight I would want to see while burying a relative. And this happens. I had the privilege to travel across British Columbia. And one thing that I learned through my travels is that our time to stand up is now. Because if we don't do something soon, there's not going to be a very bright future for our children. But if we all work together as First Nation communities all across the country, if we all start working together and fighting for the same common goal, we can defeat this oppressor that's oppressing us on an unimaginable scale.
Hey, hi, 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 hi
Welcome back to After the Collapse with Jim Vernon and Louis Maroney. I'm Louis, and we are at afterthecollapse.net and also air on radioregent.com. This episode catches a fiery talk by Mi'kmaq warriors Suzanne Patlis and Cody Stevens at the Toronto Council Fire Native Cultural Centre in Toronto's East End. We just listened to the Warrior Song performed live at the talk.
I can go on all day about the issues in the First Nation communities. They send in experts in my reserve to fix these problems, yet here's the experts, they learn from the books. They should start taking people that live the struggle, because those people live the struggle. They know the best. We need to start gathering these communities up and start creating a culture of resistance where we don't take this no more, where we stand up and we start taking back what's ours. People always say, oh, our land was stolen from us. Our land was not stolen from us. Our land is still here. We need to start reoccupying the land. So I'm going to go into a little bit what happened in El Zibuktu, because I can go on all night about that. But that's why I became a warrior, and it's important for me to give the best, to build a solid foundation for my son's future and for future generations of our people. And that's what led me to El Zibuktu. Actually, we had fought, like Sue said, had mentioned earlier, we fought an oil company by the name of Petroworth. They went broke. That was the very first, my first experience with oil companies. And at the time, they were a little, to me, it seemed like they were a little aggressive. But they seemed aggressive, but they ended up leaving. They were broke, and they didn't get one piece of equipment in our territory, not one piece. So we had won that fight. We got a 10-year moratorium in Nova Scotia that fracking ain't allowed. That was 3 years ago, so we got seven years to go. So that leads me to El Zibuktu. El Zibuktu is about six hours from my community, and I was at a point in my life where I was still suffering from addiction, and I was lost. I said, okay, so I had to leave Waikagma, which is my community. I had to leave. I wanted out. So I started hitchhiking. I said, either I go to Eskazoni or I can go to El Zibuktu. Eskazoni is about an hour away. El Zibuktu is 6 hours away, and I'm hitchhiking. So I got on the road, and before you know it, I got a ride to like a couple hours away. And I started getting closer to El Zibuktu. And before you know it, I was like, I said, either I can go to Eskazoni or El Zibuktu. So I kept getting closer to El Zibuktu. So I had made up my mind then I want to go to El Zibuktu. When I first got there, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know where I was going. And I didn't know the environment I was heading into. But I knew that when I got there, all I had to do was find the warriors and I would be all right. So I was there not even 5 minutes. I said, where's the warriors? I gotta find the warriors. I wanna meet up with them. Like 5 minutes later, I seen this convoy of vehicles, about 10 vehicles. They said, there's the warriors. And I ran on there, I got on with them. That was my first experience with meeting up with RCMP during that summer. We went up to a camp in Salmon River. And on the way up, the site I seen was during our convoy, our first experience was two RCMP cruisers. And we just went by, they moved out of the way. We got a little bit further and the RCMP kept getting thicker, the line. And they let us through again. The third one, they had all these cars on blocking the road and RCMP had a big line. But it was through some negotiating and someone had called the captain of the military, and the military told the RCMP to open their blockade they made, and we went through. So as we got a little further up the mountain, the women had a camp set up. The RCMP had raided their camp. They, for some reason, they seized their smudging equipment, they seized their drums and their flags. They seemed to find a big threat from these items. I can see why, because it brings a lot of people together. And they seized all this stuff, and the women were screaming. They said, the effing cops are crazy. They're in our camp. And when we got there, the RCMP seeing how many warriors, they didn't stick around very long. They were gone. They were gone like a bat out of hell. So we stayed there for about maybe a week and a half. During that week and a half, it was a good time. It was a good time for all the warriors to get to know each other because we were all in the woods and we had our own blockade. And we had got wind that the company is taking off for a bit, that they were going to go back home and go through all whatever they had to do and come back. So we heard they were gone. So we decided to go to Rogersville. This was a very important time during all the blockade because it got everybody together. It was our time to get involved with public relations. It was our time to gather allies. And it was a time to get everybody together. And we got lots of people together, as you guys seen on what happened in El Zibukdu. And we were there for about maybe 3 to 4 weeks. And finally, I made up my mind. I said, I want to go home for a bit and go see my son. And when I come back, I'll come back when the company comes back. This is my time to rest because I was getting a little tired. So I had gone home and I heard that the company was back and that the Warrior Society had seized equipment. My first thought was to go on YouTube to see, because I knew it was very public what was going on, so I went on YouTube. What I seen was there were so many people that decided to do a round dance, that their compound, which is about 300 feet by 400 feet, they had enough people to do a round dance around that whole compound. And that's when I decided, I said, man, I seen that. I said, a little spark in my heart. I said, I'm going back. Here I was on the road hitchhiking again. I made it to El Zibukdu again before dark. And when I got there, I got to Rex and people were like, don't wear your camo. If you wear your camo, they're going to arrest you. They're going to harass you. And so I put all my regular clothes over my camo. But when I got closer, I said, I want to wear my colors proud. I said, I want to wear my colors. I want to wear my camo. So when I got to the blockade, there was two RCMP cruisers. People were getting searched going through the middle. I said, why don't I go through the side? So I had all my camo on. I went through the side. They didn't even see me. So I got in. During that time in Rexton, it was the most amazing time in my life because earlier, as I mentioned about that 10 years of institutional oppression, I had lost all my pride. That was my opportunity to get all my pride back. Like I said, the feathers and the drums and the medicine brings people together. It brought me together and it made that fire in my heart roaring. It was going full blast. And seeing people drum and seeing people coming together was the most amazing feeling that you could ever have. There was one time in particular where we had 500 people all coming up marching for the same cause. And we had one girl, she was dressed in regalia. We had the women drummers behind the girl in the regalia, and there was warriors behind them to show a form of protection. And they felt safe. They felt safe to walk up the street, and they sang the honor song. It was the most amazing thing you could ever see. So many people all fighting for the same cause. And after that, I was addicted to that feeling of pride I had. I couldn't stay away. So I was there about 2 weeks, and the girls had asked me, they said, we're going through the woods, so we do a little drumming through the woods. And we don't want, last night we heard something in the woods, and we want someone to come with us. I said, I'll come. And to get away from all the other work, I said, I'll come in the woods with you guys and hear the songs they were singing. So when we walked in the woods, we were doing psychological warfare. We would get to certain checkpoints that the RCMP had set up. And when we got there, we would sing drum. The women would drum. The songs were so awesome. It was the most amazing feeling I had. There was times when they were singing, I would cry because of that feeling. And when they would sing, you should see the RCMP scrambling all over their checkpoint. They're worrying. So after we're done freaking the RCMP out, we would go back down. We would go back down into the grass, and then we would crawl and pop out in another checkpoint, do the same thing. We did that all night, and it gave me an opportunity to get to know the women and their songs and their drums Before I met the women, I thought I was traditional. But they showed me a new way of tradition I had never seen. And for them, their songs, when they drum, it's a prayer that they sing. And this one time in particular, they were drumming. I never believed in spirits, but this time, when they were singing, I could see fireflies in the woods going like this. And in the end of October, back home in our territory, you don't get fireflies. So I believe they were spirits. Either that or they were RCMP with their night vision goggles. But it was amazing seeing those lights, and they were spirits. And it was after that, I felt so much pride, and it was amazing. And I had gone, on October 16, I went to Elsiebuk to do some laundry. And while I was there, I got a call saying that there's a raid happening in the camp. I've gotten calls before and about raids, but it was like the boy who cried wolf. I finally didn't believe it. And then finally I got on Facebook and I seen more people were talking on there. I said, holy crap, this raid is really happening. So Elsiebuk is about 15 minutes from Rex, and I was there in 10 minutes. So when we got there, the RCMP had another checkpoint. They said, you can walk through, but you can't bring your vehicle in. So we went to go park our vehicle. And when we made an attempt to walk through the blockade, they said, no, if you go through the blockade, you're going to get arrested. So I said, I'm getting out of here. There was too many cops, and I wasn't going to take the risk. So I went to another location. As I was walking to the other location, the RCMP said, what's in your bag? And they surrounded me. And when they surrounded me, they grabbed my bag. And my bag is camouflage, military-style bag. They said, where's the grenades? We know you got the grenades. They thought I had a bag full of grenades. So they rushed my bag. And here they are, focusing all their energy on my bag. I can see them looking in there. They were pissed off to find out it was just clean clothes in there. So when I see them all searching in my bag, I said, here's my chance. I made a run for it. I went to the woods. I said, I'm going to go in the best way where I think I'll get away. The RCMP must have been thinking the same thing because they were waiting for me in the woods. I got surrounded, and during that time I was getting surrounded, I managed to get a cigarette lit because I knew this might be my last cigarette. And they said, what's your name? What's your name? I said, my name is Nigel Stevens, which is my brother's name. They didn't buy it. They said, that's Cody Stevens and he's arrestable. They already did their research. They knew who I was. They knew all about me. They had put the handcuffs on me, and I still had the cigarette in my mouth. And then all I could hear in the background was, and all I could explain it was like someone takes a bag of firecrackers and lights the whole thing. I was thinking, why is someone lighting firecrackers? I said. And then it dawned on me. Those aren't firecrackers. Those are guns they're shooting. And it was difficult getting arrested and hearing those guns go off because they were less lethal rounds they were firing, but I didn't know that. Some were lethal. There were some less lethal rounds. And to me, in my mind, everyone was getting slaughtered back there, which was my thought. And I was pretty pissed off. And I gave the cop a hard time. And when he was arresting me, after me giving a hard time, I still had the cigarette in my mouth. They slammed me to the ground, and the cigarette landed between the ground and my face. And I flinched away, and because the cigarette was burning, I flinched away. I said, oh, I'm burning. And as I flinched away, I got charged for obstruction of justice, attempting to headbutt the officer. And he put my head back down, and when he put my head back down, he was twisting my head and to put the cigarette out. I flinched again. I said, oh, I'm burning. And then I flinched. I got charged for resisting an officer. But I got arrested. And when I got arrested, I was in the back seat of the cop car, and I was pissed off after hearing all those gunshots. And I kind of lost it, and I broke the cop car door. It was hanging off the wires, and it was broken in half. And I said, I'm screwed now, I said. They didn't figure out that door. As I was getting arrested, the RCMP line was getting overrun. That was one of the cop cars that got on fire. They didn't have no evidence to charge me.
Thank you.
During what happened next was difficult part, but I can't talk about it because there were things the RCMP did to me, and I want to bring justice. I want to let people know what they did, but now's not the time because we still got two political prisoners in jail. And one thing I learned, the more you resist the RCMP, they keep coming back to my friends in the jail and they keep giving them more charges. So I'm gonna wait till after they're sentenced anyway. So they took me to the jail, and when I got to the jail, what I seen was, I seen a armored personnel carrier, 8 wheels on it, an army tank. Those RCMP were ready for war against my people.
Yeah.
And the things they did, the things that occurred over the next couple of days, they put the RCMP blocked off the Kansas Causeway, which was the only link from Cape Breton to Nova Scotia. They did blockades, they cut my people off. And that was kind of scary because how they could do something like that and just not allow Indians through, they could just as easily round us up and do whatever they want. And that kind of freaks me out. So after seeing that armored personnel carrier, I was a little pissed off. I was the first one arrested on that day. And I was waiting. I said, okay, I knew the raid was going down, and I knew people were going to start flooding in soon. Before you know it, they started flooding in. And it was full of inmates in there. And during that time, I kept instigating the guards because I knew I've been in jail before, and I knew how to pick at them. And that's what I did. And they said, tonight we're going to release some people on a promise to appear. And I was waiting for my turn. And every time they came to get someone, I was like, when's my turn? When's my turn? My turn didn't come. And they said, we're going to take people to court, and we're going to release them from court the next day. Here I am waiting again, waiting for my turn. My turn didn't come. So I had to do a bail hearing for 2.5 days. During that bail hearing, the RCMP and the crowd kept bringing up my past, that 10 years of institutional oppression I was speaking about earlier. They kept bringing that up, and they kept using that against me. This guy's an evil man. This guy does this. This guy does this to his community. And I told them, I'm not this evil man you guys think. And I told them what I just finished telling you guys about our government and how they treated our people. And the judge didn't buy it. And they denied me bail. During my bail hearing, they kept the need to keep bringing up the RCMP cruisers. They'll say, furthermore, 6 RCMP cruisers got caught on fire. And those RCMP cruisers got caught on fire at 1:30 in the afternoon. I was arrested at 8:30 in the morning. But all of the Warrior Society was arrested by 1:30.
By 10 p.m.
10 a.m. And when we got to jail, I was denied my bail. They put us into general population. And I slept good. I got pretty comfortable because I knew how to survive in the institution. I got pretty comfortable. I made my bed and put my pillowcase. And mind you, I was sleeping in the TP all summer, so I was kind of looking forward to a warm, dry bed. So I slept good that whole night. And the next day, I heard correctional staff. There was about 7 or 8 of them marching in. And they went to the first 2 warriors. They extracted them. And they did that to the next guys. They extracted them. And I knew I was next. So when they came, I said, good luck. You guys ain't getting me out of here. They said, we'll get you out. He said, we'll go put on the riot gear. We'll get you out. So I knew they were looking for an excuse to come in with their riot gear. So I cooperated, and I went with them. Over the next 3 weeks, they put us in solitary confinement, which is 23 hours a day you're locked in the cell, and half hour you're allowed to shower, half hour outside. 3 weeks, they didn't let me call my mother. The last thing my mother knew was that we were all getting shot at. She didn't know what we were getting shot at with. I just wanted to call her to let her know I was okay. They wouldn't give me that opportunity. They said it was for institutional means or something like that, that they weren't allowed us to make phone calls to the outside world, or that we weren't allowed to have contact with other inmates, and they separated us. There were 6 of us, they put us in groups of 2 for 3 weeks. During that time in the hole, they strip searched us about every two, three days. And the strip searches were all the time. How are you supposed to bring in contraband when you're locked in the cell for 23 hours a day?
That's right.
There was a tray that went missing this big. what did they do? They strip searched me for the trip. They didn't find it. But that was their way of trying to break me. They kept me in the hole. So finally I said, I need to smudge. I want to keep that tradition that I had gained, that pride I had gained. I want to keep it going in the jails. I put in 6 official requests, written requests to the Department of Public Safety in New Brunswick for see if I can get smudging. We were denied. They said, oh, we'll see what we can do. It's hard to find someone on a volunteer basis. This is what the chaplain said, and here he was getting paid to be a chaplain in the jail. And I asked him again, I said, we need our smudging. This was like the 3rd request. And he said, we can't do it yet. We're trying to find a volunteer. But if you want, in the meantime, here's the Holy Bible while you're waiting. So I took the Holy Bible. I had some tobacco back in the cell, and I needed some rolling paper. So I took it. But it was these repeated attempts to break us all through our incarceration. Then our lawyers did a press conference telling them about the way we were being treated and the way we were being denied our traditional medicines. When you're in a place like that, you need something to have hope. And that my hope was through tradition. They denied me that. That's a human right they denied me.
Yeah.
And it kind of, when I got out on December 20th, after two months in there, I went to court. And at court, they said, they charged me with forcible confinement of 7 security guards. Oh. And it was, I was facing about 2.5 years in prison with my record. And I didn't want to go to prison. And they said, if you plead guilty to the headbutt incident with the cigarette and the resisting arrest, we'll drop the forcible confinement. So I had to plead guilty. Either that or I had to stay in February to fight it, till February, and I would just be getting out. So I chose to plead guilty because I wanted to be home to see my family, as on December 20 was my trial date. I got out. They dropped so many charges, but they felt the need to keep these big charges, and the judge would say, I got charged with assault to a security guard too, and the assault was just tapping him on the shoulder, telling him, could you please go back into the compound? And I got charged for assault. But I had to plead guilty to that, and I did. And during that time in jail, I had received so many letters. I had received letters from people from all around the world, from United Kingdom, Australia, Ireland, all across the United States, all across Turtle Island. It was amazing. It kept me have that hope. When I got out, after them denying me my traditional medicines, I couldn't smudge for 3 weeks. It was took me 3 weeks to get back in touch with my tradition. And I remember when I got released, Sue came to pick me up and my mom. And on her way back home, she told me about a trip she had made to Toronto. And I said, Sue, next time you go to speak, I want to share my story. I want people to hear my story too. She called me back 2 days later. She said, I hope you're ready. We're going to BC. And we went to BC, and it was a good learning experience. And we all, as First Nation people, we all have different struggles in the reserve, but we all share the same struggle. We all share the same oppressor. And these governments and the oppressor that's oppressing us has horrible plans for our people. And I believe it's in the best interest of my children and for our people. I no longer do this because I want to. Now I'm doing this because I have no choice. I have to look out for my children. And coming here and seeing so much unity and so much support across different nations and seeing all different people come together, this is our time to get together and to start planning stuff. And we need to create that culture of resistance, and we need to start fighting and taking back what was stolen from us, because we need those things, and we need to bring back culture to our reserve. We need to bring back tradition. We need to be Indian again. I've been to so many First Nation communities, and like some of them, like such as Sarnia, how are you supposed to practice your traditional hunting if you got industry all the way around, or if your fish are polluted? And it's Sarnia is a pretty good example of what industry has planned for all our communities. Yeah. And we can look to Sarnia, and we can we can all learn, and we can all see the devastation that they had, these industries have done to Sarnia, and we can't allow them to continue to do this. And we must start taking actions, and we need to start moving together as a nation, and we all need to get together. Thank you for everyone for coming out to hear us speak, and I would like to say thank you, and thank you very much. Thank you.
She asked me to have some last words, so I guess I should have some. But when we take a look at the indigenous resurgence that happened back in when Idle No More first started off, and where it united all of people from all different colors, and why people united, it was for the water. And this is what we have to keep inside of our own minds and hearts, that we're fighting because of the water. And this is what all of the connections all across these indigenous nations, from the Mapuche down in southern Chile to up here in our territories, it's all about the water, trying to leave our water pristine and pure for our future generations. So we're no longer in the woods trying to hunt. We're no longer out on the water trying to fish, because if we don't have that water, none of that is going to exist, and we're not going to be able to do any of that. So we're all taking this stance to protect our water, and that's what everybody was standing up for back then, yet a lot of people got lost in legislation. And instead of thinking what was the foundational uniting element of that movement, and it was the water, and that's why the movement was so big out east, because everybody was connected to that water. And out west, that's what everybody's connected to. Even when you want to think about the people who are being oppressed by the US government in Afghanistan, the Pathan, people want to call them terrorists, but they're not. They're fighting for the same thing, and it's water. All of the people all across the world are fighting for that water, and they're being oppressed because of greed, because of corporate colonialism. They're coming in to steal oil and destroy water and to criminalize people and to make them look like they're criminals and terrorists for trying to stand up and saying no to corporate colonialism. So we must all unite together and make that stand and to say no, we're not taking this anymore. And I'm glad that we're able to bring our fire of resistance here, and I hope it continues to burn inside of your hearts, just like it did with the fire, with the tires on the road. See that? That's the fire in our hearts out on the open. So let's unite and stand together. Wallalio.
Thanks for listening to After the Collapse with Jim Vernon and Louis Moroni. I'm Louis, and we are at afterthecollapse.net and air on radioregent.com. You've been listening to Mi'kmaq warriors Suzanne Patlis and Cody Stevens at the Toronto Council Fire Native Cultural Center in Toronto's East End. Patlis and Stevens were on a speaking tour to spread information about their work resisting the encroachment of industrial fracking in the area surrounding Elsabooktook First Nation in New Brunswick, and the legal battles that followed in its wake. For more information on their story and related links, please visit afterthecollapse.net. Thanks.